Would you open God's precious holy word to Psalm 4? It is in the same vein as Psalm 3 in that David is still being pursued by Absalom, his son. Psalm 3 is seen as his morning prayer. Psalm 4 is seen as his evening prayer. Yahweh makes me abide in safety. We have to appreciate, in reflecting upon the situation behind the psalm and the psalmist's danger, how stressful he must be, because the overwhelming numbers of people are after him. He's been there before, but now he's there again. The multitudes at this point have aligned themselves with his son Absalom. People thought it was time for a change. David was the old guy, and Absalom was the new, handsome, up-and-coming guy. We studied that some many, many, many months ago when we were studying David and his reign back in 2 Samuel. Psalm 4, then, is to be seen as his evening prayer. Yahweh makes me abide in safety. Well, let's see how he sees it. Again, the Hebrew version that I take my verses from, whenever there's a superscript like to the conductor, when there's a title to it, the Hebrew always separates that as a separate verse. So that's why I run a verse, behind or ahead? I have 9 verses. I think y'all have 8 verses. So just keep that in mind. God, number one, God hears my prayers. To the conductor with melodious stringed instruments, a psalm of David. The Hebrew phrase there that describes the orchestration, I think the Hebrew is nagnot, it speaks of a very lovely melody. Sometimes you can extract from the superscript that it's supposed to be dynamic or it's supposed to be in a minor doleful key. But here, this is something that is just a very pleasant thing to listen to. You can think of a pleasant orchestration of something. This is a calming piece of music, a song or a psalm of David. When I call, answer me. Now, I have highlighted in blue through these slides the various requests that David makes of Yahweh. His first request in his prayer, answer me. Now he says, when I call, answer me, God, my righteousness. David claims nothing of his own. I mean, this is the only way we can have a relationship with God. It's the only way we can pray to God. As in the King James language, Job called it a day's man, a daysman, a referee, an umpire, somebody who stands between where we are and where God is. Of course, that's Jesus Christ. He is both God and man, and he joins us together. And this thought has to be in David's mind, for we see in other psalms, as well as in the exclamations in his life when he was king, that David had a fairly good grip on the doctrine of Christ. He called him the name. That was David's reference when they were bringing the Ark of the Covenant in on that wagon. The guy who wasn't supposed to touch it touched it to steady it, and he died. God killed him. David saw the ark as representative of the one who has the name. That was his title for Messiah. The name. Point being, in several places in his life, and certainly in multitudinous places in his Psalms, David is inspired of the Holy Spirit to have in his day, as far as he could, a very good and deep understanding of the doctrine of the Christ. So he pleads through Christ, God, my righteousness. He knows he has no righteousness of his own. None of us do. So it's like praying in Jesus' name, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. He's calling on God, his righteousness. He says, answer me in my distress. And the Hebrew word means I'm in a tight spot. I'm in a narrow place. In my distress, you have relieved. And there that word means to be made wide open, or you've enlarged me. You've relieved my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. So here's another request. Answer me and then be gracious to me and hear my prayer. Now, I have it in red because that's sort of the theme of the first two verses that I've put up here. So he cries out to God his righteousness. He's calling on God my righteousness. So therein, the plea takes him right before the only one who can help him and acknowledges in the request that he has no righteousness other than what God would give to him. And he pleads, he requests for God to answer him. But then he asks for God to be gracious. He also knows that he doesn't really deserve any breaks in life. None of us do. If we had what we deserved, it would be a horrible thing for us, for everybody. But again, in crying out to God, his righteousness, he pleads for grace. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. It is by the grace of God that he would hear our prayer. Today, we are told in the book of Hebrews, he's enthroned and on a throne of grace. It's different for us because our Redeemer, our righteousness, has come, has died, has paid the price, has redeemed us, has torn asunder the veil that separates everybody from the Holy of Holies, wherein is the Ark of the Covenant, and upon which it sits is the mercy seat, and he is mercy seated. So we come to the Lord knowing that he is enthroned in grace. He is grace, and so we can freely call upon him. Well, in an Old Testament sense, this is how David is appealing to God. Remember, he is surrounded by hostile troops. He has a few who have remained loyal to him, but nothing in the numbers of those who were following Absalom. He doesn't have the political leaders behind him. He doesn't have certain of the priesthood behind him. And so that puts him in distress, in a tight place. And he is so stressed, he is in such a stressful place that all he can call upon is the grace of God. He can't call upon an army. He can't call upon the strength of his sword. At the age that he is, he doesn't really have any strength left to fight with the sword as he did as a younger man. He can only call on the one who is his righteousness to be gracious to him and thus hear his prayer. It's only by grace that God would open himself up to our prayers. We can freely go to him today Of course, Christ is our high priest, and God is enthroned on the throne of grace. But here, David sees it from the Old Testament sense that he pleads with God, and he pleads for him to be gracious. Doesn't deserve a thing, that God would hear his prayer. Then he says, Yahweh hears me when I call. Sons of men, how long will my glory become a reproach, a shame? Shame, reproach. How long will you love what is worthless and seek falsehood? Selah. There's that powerful term again where everything just stops. And now everybody who listens to the song has nothing but silence to ponder what has just been said and what has just passed and been presented in the song. So he calls out to those, he calls them sons of men. That's not the most, that's not the most attractive term that one could be called. These sons of men meant that they were separated really in their quest from where God is and what God's purpose is. How long will my glory become a shame or a reproach? Now, his glory is that he is the King of Israel. He is the anointed of God, and he is the one with whom God has entered into a covenant. And all about the reign of David is a reign of glory. He's had success. He expanded the borders of the land. He brought all the tribes together and made Israel a great nation. He was a great feared warrior in the world. He didn't fail. He went to God first, and then God said, the battle is yours, or God would restrain him from a battle at certain points. And he was always the man who was in pursuit of God's heart, God's will, God's way. Now he refers to those who are trying to oust him from the throne, who are really trying to kill him. They're after him. I mean, the only way this is going to succeed is with David's death. It couldn't succeed any other way. And David knows that. How long will you love that which is worthless and seek falsehood? It is an empty and futile thing to pursue a quest that is not in the purpose or will of God. God has not excused David from the covenant of being the king and being on the throne. God hasn't done that. This is a thing of the sons of men. This is not a thing of God. And so David sees and proclaims that it's a worthless, useless, and empty thing. Now he's praying this when all the odds are against him. You are doing something that is worthless, and you're standing on a falsehood. There was no foundation of truth that it was time for a son of David to take the throne. That was completely false. Everything about the pursuit that Absalom had placed himself in was false. It was wicked. It was false. The whole thing is counterfeit. And so in his prayer, he cries out through God to the sons of men, you changed my glory to shame, but it's going to be worthless. And it's false. It has nothing to stand on. Selah. Stop. Pause. Think about that. Next verse. But know that Yahweh has set apart the Holy One or the Godly One. It means, I guess, the New Testament word would be saint. I guess it's a separated one, a holy one. When God separates someone to himself or for his purpose or to a particular task, he is separated, he's set apart by God, and God there in that separation sanctifies that person to himself for that person's salvation or that person's task, whatever it may be, and it's for himself. So this is for God. How are you going to fight God? Know that Yahweh has set apart, and of course, the Holy One would be David here in this context. The Holy One for himself. Yahweh hears when I call to him. Again, David appeals to the truth that he has a living, active, and ongoing covenant with Yahweh. Yahweh has not broken that covenant, or neither has Yahweh brought it to an end. Yahweh doesn't do that. I mean, only when David dies, Solomon becomes king. Only then is the covenant transferred to the son. So the way that's working here is completely wrong and false and worthless and useless. It will come to nothing because God has separated David for this task until God is through with him. Obviously, God is not through with him. And so he proclaims, Yahweh hears when I call to him. And David can say that on the basis of the covenant, the Davidic covenant, and on the basis of how God has delivered him from, and at this point in his life, he's been in a lot of tight spots. And he was delivered every time. So he can with confidence proclaim that Yahweh hears him in his prayer when he calls to Yahweh. Next, the appeal for us to trust in Yahweh. So I said this is the evening prayer. Here's David. It's bedtime. Tremble, but don't sin. He would say tremble because he did not personally have the resources or the strength to deliver him from the situation that he had been placed in. He didn't have anything at this point. So to tremble is to recognize one's inability, one's absolute ineptitude with regard to conquering the situation. He didn't have it. And if he tried to figure it out on his own, he would sin. It would be a sin. Only God can, you know, it's God's covenant. Only God initiated the covenant. David didn't initiate it. God imposed the covenant on David. David couldn't do anything about it. And when God imposed the covenant on David, that covenant was on the basis of who God is, not on the basis of who David is. There was more than just now in the context that God could have taken the covenant away in David's life because of David's sin, but he didn't. So the whole thing was by the strength of God, this covenant. David recognizes that he's totally dependent upon God, so recognizing his inability, he doesn't want to move forward and sin. Now you see that. You see that in the scriptures, and things get really messed up when someone, you know, takes it upon themselves to do something. Peter, for example, he didn't realize how idiotic it was for him to equate the Son of God with Moses and Elijah. He wanted to build a tabernacle for each of them. Well, that equated the Son of God with those other two guys. That was wrong. He just busted through on his own volition and cognizance, and he should have kept his mouth shut. Same way with Abram and Sarai when she gave her handmaid to Abram. You know, Abram could have said no, right? He could have said no. I'm not going to do this. This is the Canaanite way. This is not Yahweh's way. But he didn't. And world's in a mess today because of it. It teeters on the brink of world destruction. And it has. You look back in the history of these people who came forth from Ishmael They are and always have been a mess. And it continues even to this day, although the scriptures teach me that it's all of that mess is soon to be brought to an end by the act of God through Israel. Well, that said, I had an old preacher tell me one time, he was confused. He had a strong evangelistic worldwide ministry. He and I were friends. He called me. Things were going great, particularly in Brazil. He was ministering in Brazil. He's a Southern Baptist evangelist. But literally hundreds of thousands of people responding to his message of Christ. And that carried him into other parts of South America. He already had a tremendous crusade ministry in the United States. He left one of the largest churches in the Southern Baptist Convention because he was having more requests for evangelistic meetings than he could do anything with. And in his prayer, he knew God was leading him into vocational evangelism. And it really turned out to be a very powerful thing for him. And he called me when things were just at their height with his evangelistic association and all. He called me on the phone. He said, "I want you to pray for me." A very large church in Florida had called him to be the pastor. Enthralled by the size and the position of the church, I say geographical position is what I mean. And it was what preachers always called a blowing and going church. You know, I mean, they were just really, really something. And their pastor had retired, and he was good friends with that pastor. And it was a perfect kind of church, very conservative, Bible-believing, perfect thing for him. They gave him carte blanche, whatever he wanted. They offered him all kinds of stuff and money and pay and benefit, just everything. He told me all about it on the phone. And he said, "You know," he said, "the minute I did it and hung up with them, I came under great, deep, heavy conviction. And I prayed and I could not be released from this heavy conviction that I had done the wrong thing." The sad thing is there's a domino effect, because one of the things was that this particular evangelist, preacher, had told him that he would have to bring in his own staff, which is a very huge staff. And they didn't wait for him. They just went ahead and fired the whole staff that was there. I mean, they made it right for them, I'm sure. But without him being on the... Well, he calls back and he says, "I'm doing the wrong thing. I can't come." "What do you mean? We done fired the staff. You know, we don't have anybody here, man." Big church. And he was so troubled. But he told him, he said, "I can't fight this. The only peace I have is to continue doing what I'm doing." And he called me when he was calling pastors and he asked us to pray for him and for that church. And he told me this. He said, "You know, when you don't know what to do, you better not do anything at all." That's pretty good advice. I've taken that advice through the years. If you're in confusion and you don't really know what to do, you don't need to jump at it. You need to wait till the still small voice comes along, and it does, it will. And I know he was embarrassed. He was mortified by his own actions of taking that church so quickly. And he continued on until he died, I guess. He's dead now in his evangelistic ministry. But that would have been a good advice for a lot of people in the Bible. When you don't know what to do, you better not do anything at all. Just wait on the Lord. David will have that in a psalm later on. So here, he says to himself, "Tremble, but don't sin. Don't get out here and act before God acts. Ponder in your heart upon your bed, but be still." You can think about things and think about what you would do and this, you know. You can dream and imagine, but you don't do anything until God says do it. And you have the direction in your heart to do it. So then the next verse he says, offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in Yahweh. So this is what he would do. He would offer sacrifices. And in his special worship, he would express completely and absolutely that his trust was in Yahweh. It wasn't in himself. It wasn't in what few counselors he had that were still loyal to him. He didn't count anything other than the will and direction and guidance of Yahweh. And I can tell you this, when you've been there enough times, you'll know what it feels like when Yahweh is guiding you in the direction in which you should go. Finally, Yahweh alone makes me dwell in safety. David couldn't do it for himself. The vast army that he had just a few days earlier was no longer his army, practically. He had no way of guaranteeing his own safety. Yahweh alone makes me dwell in safety. Many are saying, who will show us good? And here's his next request. Lift up the light of your face upon us, Yahweh. The brightness of your countenance. Turn your face toward us. This always bespeaks of the pleasure of God. He's pleased. His countenance, he faces them, and he looks at them with his gentle, loving, kind, caring face. So here's his request. Lift up the light of your face upon us, Yahweh. You have put gladness in my heart. Hey, he's about to die. They're yelling at him and calling him names and making fun of him and whacking away at the high weeds and poking everywhere behind the rocks, thinking they're going to kill him, you know. You have put gladness in my heart more than when their grain and new wine abound. I'm happy, in peace. I'm going to go to bed. Now, he said that last time, you may remember. We talked about Solomon in Ecclesiastes. Poor old emaciated Solomon who'd just lost himself. Talked about the value of sleep, and he didn't have it. David finds it even in the most difficult of circumstances. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, Yahweh, make me to abide in safety. Bodyguards couldn't help. I mean, just, there was no other way for him to feel safe. But it's okay, I'm going to roll over and go to sleep. Now suppose you were out in a field somewhere, maybe a blanket, maybe not, and there were torches all about, and there were curses and swearings and threatenings and intimidations. We're going to find you, old man. We're going to put you on the end of a spear, make a shish kebab out of you. All kind of things they would have said to try to frighten him. And with all that noise and with all those torches there just not too far in the distance and all of that slashing of the weeds and of the bushes and of their searches of David, he says, I'm not going to worry about it. Yahweh has a covenant with me, and only Yahweh will make me abide in safety, and that's all I need, so I'm going to go to sleep now. And that's how it ends. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, Yahweh, make me to abide in safety. Well, we'll stop there and have our deacon prayer time.